Some of you, whom we welcome so warmly on this Easter morning, will not have known that for weeks we have been analyzing from this pulpit the qualities of agape love, that unique Christian approach to life which the Apostle Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13. We began the series exactly 5 months ago, and I meant from the very start to carry it right through this special morning, although I will confess that I managed the order of topics so that this sermon would concentrate on the one word that sums up what Easter is all about. That word is hope. And it is so universally acknowledged to be essential to human life that we can make a joke out of pretending otherwise. I saw a bumper sticker, Larry, the other day that said, "Now that I've given up hope, I feel much better." I liked it because there have been times when I've said that to myself. If I could just stop hoping, I'd be happier about all sorts of things that seem unfixable. But of course, if it were literally true that the driver I saw had given up hope, he wouldn't be around to proclaim it. He wouldn't be driving because there would be no place he hoped to reach. He wouldn't have stuck the sticker on the bumper in the first place because he'd have no hope that anyone would read it and smile at his little joke. The truly hopeless simply die, sometimes physically, sometimes metaphorically. That is, they are dead in life. I think the nicest compliment ever paid to Franklin Delano Roosevelt was spoken by his wife, who said, "I have never known a man who gave one a greater sense of security. That was because I never heard him say that there was a problem impossible for human beings to solve." You may or may not like the way Mr. Roosevelt chose to solve the problems of the Great Depression, but he went at it with astonishing energy and optimism. I wish we had a little more of both in our national leadership. Things get done by people filled with hope. And why are we talking about hope when the sermon series has been about love? Well, the answer is that maybe that's the answer. Certainly represents hope. The answer to that question I just asked is that hope is part of what Christian love means. In Paul's description of that love, he says there is no fading of its hope. It can outlast anything. And that is good news because there isn't a person in this room who is not sustained by some kind of hope that you will graduate and get a good job, that your beloved wife will feel better soon, that your husband will come to his senses before it's too late, that your child will find better friends and stay out of trouble. I talked to a man a few days ago who sustains a difficult and lonely life by hoping that he will live to see the 21st century come. "I don't know," he says, "I just want to write that date on a letter one time, January 1, 2000. And some of you, not in the habit of coming, dressed and came this morning in the hope that something good would happen in this house. You may recall from your art history class a famous painting by George Watts, in which he tries to picture how desperately we hang on to hope. You remember that woman with a bandage over her eyes, sitting stooped and desolate in what looks like an empty universe, trying to make music on one string of a broken harp? The picture isn't popular now because we are not fond of painters who preach. And Watts was preaching. Preaching that hope is incredibly stubborn, that it takes the last broken thing left in a vacant world and tries to make a song. I like another way of saying it, perhaps because of my background, by means of poetry instead of painting. And in this particular case, from the Bible, by way of an ancient Hebrew poet whose name was Zechariah. His graphic word picture is buried in a context familiar to all of us. He's talking about some of his friends who have seen life turned upside down, but who are living bravely in the expectation that things are going to get better. He calls these people, in what I think is a matchless phrase, prisoners of hope. Prisoners of hope. I visited two of these people, prisoners, in the past few days, gallant men, members of this church, who are fighting courageously at home or in the hospital against diseases that are called incurable. Both of them know perfectly well how doctors view their future, but both of them are prisoners of hope. They can't help it any more than the rest of us. Destroy our world, break the instruments by which our songs were made, make it hard for us to see even a ray of light, and we still pluck away on that last string in the hope of hearing one more time the sound of music. We do it, I suppose, because we sense that even physical life is hardly sustainable without hope. I knew a woman, gravely ill, whose 5 grown children had all come to be with her. One evening, she said how it worried her for all of them to be away from their jobs and their own homes and children. And she went on to say, "I don't want them to see me looking like this." 2 days later, she was dead. 6 months before her doctors thought she would die. She had lost hope that tomorrow would be any better, and with hope gone, she gave up. I read a note some years ago in the British Medical Journal about the connection between hope and life. Someone studied birth and death dates in England and Wales over a set period and found a higher than expected number of elderly people dying a month or two after their birthdays. It seems, the researcher wrote, that in old age, each birthday is an achievement, a source of esteem, evidence that death has been cheated for another year. People say, "I hope to reach my next birthday," and the hope helps sustain them. So it's no wonder we resist when someone seems intent on destroying our hopes. There was a symposium one day at the KU Med Center on marriage. And in the course of it, a very capable Jewish rabbi spoke. Midway through his talk, he suddenly remarked that he thought it was wrong, morally wrong, for a man to choose to live without a wife. Instantly, a Catholic priest stood up and stomped out of the room. I can understand his distress. It wasn't simply that his way of life had been criticized. His hope had been stepped on. Because surely, if one commits himself to a lifetime of celibacy, he does it in the hope of gaining favor with God and respect from the rest of us. We don't take kindly to having our deepest hopes insulted. Marriage is a hope, and it's astonishing to me how far people will go to preserve that hope, how much they will forgive, how hard they will try to improve themselves to make it work, even when they have a nagging sense that it can't be altogether their fault. I think hope dies hard in marriage, as it does in all sorts of human relationships. The little 6-year-old boy at the wedding rehearsal stands for what I mean. His mom had been a widow for 4 years, about all the time he could remember, and now she was remarrying. All he could think about was that he was about to get a father, something the other kids talked about all the time at school. He kept waiting at the door of the church for the groom to arrive. And when that happened, the most radiant face you could ever hope to see belonged to that little boy. He said, "Hi, Dad." And the hope that had literally taken possession of his life was on his face for all of us to see. Would the man become what the little boy hoped? Who knows? We could list his strengths and weaknesses and try to predict, but the truth is that hope may not have much to do with logic anyway. It can survive on almost nothing. During the Second World War, in the concentration camps in Germany, women were put to work all day building roads. They carried dirt and rocks in their aprons because they were not provided with wheelbarrows. They used their fingernails for shovels, walking to work in cardboard shoes, eating thin soup, dragging home at night too desperate, too weary, even to talk. The survivors were asked one day after it was all over how they made it, how they got through the day. One of them said, "Oh, I don't know, but I do remember this. On the way to work, we passed a house with a flower box in the window. And in it, there were tulips blooming. We knew that if we got through another day, we got to walk back past that house and see those tulips again." Tulips. For a few weeks, hope obviously doesn't need much. The family sits in that little waiting room outside the surgical unit, where I've spent enough time over the years to know it all by heart. The plastic tables, the styrofoam cups with the coffee stains, some of them left half full on the arm of the chair, when the doctor suddenly appears, tattered and out-of-date copies of People magazine, family members trying hard to keep from showing how worried they are. Everybody stares at the door across the hall, waiting. An hour goes by, then two, sometimes three or four, and finally the door opens and the man in the laundered green surgical gown comes out, pulls down the mask, and says to the husband, "I think we got it all." The father cannot risk even trying to speak to the doctor just then, so he nods his gratitude, and then he turns around and says to the family, "Let's go down and have breakfast." On the strength of that one fragile line of words, they are ready to eat. Hope can jumpstart life again. If Easter is about hope, maybe we need to hear again what the Bible uses as metaphors of hope. The prophet Isaiah sees a cloud about the size of a man's hand far off on the distant western rim of the Mediterranean Sea, and in the midst of a long, long drought, he says, "Better get your umbrellas, folks. Rain is on the way." And that other image of hope in the scripture, the stump in the dry ground, apparently dead and lifeless, but over on one side, down near the bottom, a small green twig, and the poet prophet saying, "Just wait, it's going to grow into a mighty tree." So I beg you, treat your hopes kindly. The ones you brought with you this morning, the ones about your own life that you prefer to keep secret, and the ones about this whole mixed up world. I read the paper very early this morning, and I decided that whether you need this sermon or not, I do. I read about the escalating anger and the increasing danger of violence in the abortion controversy, about the decision to make off-duty police unavailable to keep order in Wichita, about what racist hatred did to the life of Henry Aaron, and I got up from that reading in need of a very strong dose of hope. I have a question on this day, when more than any other time in the year, those of us who go to church celebrate hope. Here it is. Do you suppose there is anything at all to the ancient promise of Isaiah that a day will come when they will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain? For the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Logic says, are you kidding? But this is a special morning, and it says, who knows? Don't stop hoping.